management for clients worldwide.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Deck the halls with boughs of holly, nativity scenes, and Santa pinups. Add to that a bright menorah, Kwanzaa flag, and 10-foot blow-up snowman on the lawn. And then let the fight begin over just what is an appropriate public celebration of the holidays. Tonight on Point, the secular and the sacred expressing multiculturalism and Christmas. But first, despite assurances that the risk is essentially zero, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has expanded its recall of meat products linked to a case of mad cow disease in Washington state to 8 western states and the U.S. territory of Guam. The discovery of the first American case of mad cow could cost the beef industry billions. 2 dozen countries, including big beef buyer Japan, have blocked U.S. beef imports. Guy Nelson is news director at Public Radio's KUOW in Seattle. I asked him to assess how Americans in the Northwest are responding to the discovery of mad cow.
People here are very concerned about what's been going on. The farmers who are in the central part of the state around the Yakima area are concerned because they're worried how this is going to affect their beef prices. They're concerned with the invasion of reporters and media from all over the world. And they're very confident, though, in the investigation that's underway by the USDA. Consumers in the bigger cities are also concerned about whether or not the meat supply is safe and whether or not the meat has found its way into stores. So a number of stores have pulled the hamburger and other cuts of meat that may possibly have been traced back to this tainted animal.
Let's look to the safety issue first. The government is saying there's essentially no risk here, but not everyone agrees. The Wall Street Journal today is quoting a Nobel Prize winner in California who's done work on mad cow, who says they can't know that.
Well, theoretically, the disease cannot be transmitted from the infected parts of the cow, which would be the brain, spinal cord, and small intestine, into the meat parts of the cow. However, with modern meat processing equipment, there is a chance that some of these mechanized saws may sever parts of the spinal cord and that very, very small amounts of the infected material may make it into the meat supply. They also say that there's no way that this infected material can be transmitted through milk.
Over the last decade, about 150 people, most of them in the United Kingdom, have died from mad cow disease, which I guess makes people very sensitive about it. A number of countries have already shut down imports of American beef.
The people who died apparently ate sausage. That's what they think in Great Britain. It's sausage that had some sort of brain matter in it. So in America, many fewer people eat brain parts, so it should probably not be such a concern to the average American consumer here. I think your chances of catching this through hamburger or other cuts meat are very low, say the officials. However, other countries have stepped up to ban imports of U.S. beef. About 30 countries so far say they don't want U.S. beef until we figure out what's going on here. Japan, in particular, is our biggest consumer of American beef. And right now, over in Tokyo, American officials are over there trying to get them to lift this ban, saying, look, it appears this cow was from Canada. There is no scientific basis for banning this beef, so would you please consider lifting it? And the Japanese are saying, no, we won't, until you tell us exactly what the facts are behind this case, exactly where the cow came from, exactly whether or not other animals from that herd could possibly be infected. We're going to keep the ban in place.
So $1 billion worth of exports and $3.2 billion globally so far shut down with that refusal and refusal by others. What about the exact source of the cow? This was a dairy cow, right, that came into the country in 2001, reportedly from Alberta, Canada?
Yes, it's been a very interesting detective case, actually, trying to figure out exactly where this cow came from and how old the cow is. And the age is important because this bone meal that supposedly transmits disease, which is made from the parts of other animals and then fed to cows, was banned in 1997 by the U.S. and Canada. But if this animal is older than that, which they say it now appears to be 6.5 years old, it's possible that as a young animal it ate this bone meal, which may have been contaminated as it was being raised in Canada.
So then came across, it was apparently used as a dairy cow on a farm in Washington state, and then after a number of years, was sold to a meat processor, and its meat became part of a batch of 10,000 pounds of hamburger that's been recalled. Is that right?
Yes. And it was mixed in, obviously, with the meat from a lot of other cattle. So the amount from this one particular diseased cow is going to be a very, very small percentage of this 10,000 pounds. But that meat was distributed throughout 8 states. And again, we're talking about very small amounts of meat. Some, one of these states may have only gotten this meat in one or two stores. So it's not like it's flooding shelves all over the place. But they have traced it to these 8 states in Guam. And they're trying to pull as much of that meat as they can so that there's absolutely no question, there's absolutely no flagging in the American confidence as to whether or not this meat is safe.
Meat distributors in the Northwest, are they in business? Are they functioning right now? Or are they waiting for new regulations, new all-clear sign?
Well, so far they're functioning. None of them have shut down, and only one has made this voluntary recall of 10,000 pounds of meat that went through its plant. And again, they're saying that they did that with an abundance of caution. They say there's no health risk at all to the public. They're only doing it to allay whatever fears the public may have about whether or not this meat is contaminated. But otherwise, they're waiting to see what's going to happen to these herds of cattle out here. The original herd in Mapton, Washington, where this cow came from, is under quarantine, as is a nearby bull calf processing facility where they send these calves to be raised. 400 animals there are under quarantine, and officials are waiting for a word as to whether or not any more animals will have to be slaughtered.
And the possibility this may yet become a real political issue. Howard Dean now is calling for a change in regulations that would change the way so-called downer cattle are tested before they're slaughtered. That is, cattle that are too sick or not strong enough to walk into the slaughterhouse currently are tested, but the meat goes into the supply before the test results are clear. He wants that done in advance, so we've got a kind of a Bush versus Dean debate over meat at the moment.
Well, it seems strange when we hear how this meat is processed that that actually happens, that they see an animal that is questionable and they do tests on it, but rather than hold the animal until the tests are done, they send the animal ahead for processing. And they say they do that because they can inspect the carcass after it's killed, and they can okay the carcass even while the brain material, the spinal cord material, is being tested. However, now the public is just not very accepting of that process, and there are questions now in Congress and elsewhere about whether different types of animals should be tested, more animals, what the test should be, and whether or not this test and hold rule should be changed. And a lot of European countries that have had problems with mad cow over the last year or two have different rules for testing. They test every animal that's over 30 months of age, which is the age at which the disease starts to be a problem. And they also have a test and hold rule where they do not let the animals go into further processing until they get positive test results back.
We may learn more about meat processing than we want to know before all this is over, but I guess there's no case with a mad cow now among us. Guy Nelson, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Tom.
Guy Nelson is news director at KUOW. He spoke with me from Seattle, Washington. During the year-end holidays, Americans celebrate the birth of Jesus, Hanukkah's Festival of Lights, and the seven principles of Kwanzaa. But when it comes to decorating the neighborhood square, school auditorium, or courthouse front lawn, it's oh holy fight. 'Tis the season for arguing and court cases. And a new assessment of what's been won and lost in the increasingly secular, multicultural season of Santa. Up next on Point, how a diverse America is pulling the plug on traditional holiday expression. Have court decisions, zoning rules, and modern manners gone too far in pushing Mary, Joseph, and Jesus, even Santa and Christmas trees, out of town? Or is multicultural, multi-religion America showing just the right amount of restraint, of diversity? Do you feel overrun by symbols of the reason for the season? Or are you hungry for more? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Middleton, New Jersey, is Kathy Young, contributing editor at Reason Magazine and a columnist for the Boston Globe. Her most recent column is headlined Christmas Tree Freedom. Good evening and welcome, Kathy Young.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you. Also with us tonight from Strongsville, Ohio, is Tom Pytek. He is an attorney and frequent contributor to Chronicles Magazine and the American Conservative. Good evening and welcome, Tom Pytek. Hello, Tom Pytek. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yes, good to have you with us. Kathy Young, let me start with you. You've written humorously but also seriously just today about this, the whole debate and kind of cultural stance these days over the holidays, over Christmas and all the rest. Are you saying that political correctness has taken over the holidays somehow?
Extent. I don't think the situation is quite bad as some people make it out to be, but at the same time, we have seen incidents like a law school in Indiana taking down a Christmas tree because some people found it offensive, or the University of Michigan issuing a kind of special warning that Christmas greetings could be offensive to some people, and similar warnings, by the way, were not issued for other holidays like Hanukkah or Kwanzaa.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think there has been some excess in this matter.
So here you are. You're looking out on America like we all are this time of year. You describe yourself as a Jewish agnostic. But as I read you, Kathy Young, you're saying maybe we've taken all this boundary drawing a little too far. How would you draw the boundary? What do you see as all right in contemporary, diverse America, and what do you see as too much expression of a particular religious holiday?
Right. Well, my position is actually fairly close to what I understand the Supreme Court's position is, which is that, first of all, decorations such as Santa or reindeer or the Christmas tree itself, or, let's say, Christmas lights, even though they're associated with a Christian holiday, are really essentially secular in nature. Therefore, their public display cannot be considered a violation of the separation of church and state. Now, specifically when it gets to explicitly Christian decorations such as nativity scenes, the Supreme Court's position is, which I essentially agree with, that it's perfectly okay to have them on public property as long as, it's part of a larger display that also includes secular symbols, and especially if it also includes displays for other holidays, such as Hanukkah, which falls around the same time seasonally. I basically agree with. I think that true diversity means that you do acknowledge different traditions. I think it is important to have some sensitivity toward the rights, essentially, of people who are minorities in a majority Christian culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is important not to make them feel excluded at this time of the year. But at the same time, I don't see why we have to trample the rights of the majority.
The rights of the majority. And you even say that you have some fear that that kind of measures, those measures could generate a backlash. Do you see signs of that?
In a really major way as yet, but I think there is some anger on the part of people who feel that they are not being allowed to celebrate their holidays the way that they want to. I saw the other day there was a story, I think out of Florida, I'm not quite sure about the location, but there was a town where essentially were a village where the display of a menorah was allowed, but at the same time the display of a Christmas tree or I believe a nativity scene was not allowed. And there were people who were upset about that, and there were people who felt that their rights were being infringed and that essentially the Jewish minority in this village was in some ways getting more rights than the Christian majority. And there have been some very sort of tortured reasoning about how supposedly the menorah is really a secular decoration, but a nativity scene is religious. And I think when you start making distinctions like that, it really can lead to the majority feeling that they are being essentially infringed upon.
Tom Pytek, I wondered as I read your piece in the American Conservative, headlined How the Left Stole Christmas, if you are the backlash, you're writing about what you describe now as Christmas as the holiday that dare not speak its name. What's going on in your view?
Well, I think it's been going on for a long time, and people are beginning to notice it. You know, one of the most obvious examples is the virtual disappearance of the word Christmas from public vocabulary. You incessantly hear about the holiday or the holidays to the point that there are references to holiday trees, even though Christmas is the only winter holiday celebrated with decorated trees, holiday songs, even though the vast majority of songs associated with this time of year are associated with Christmas. And the list can go on.
But what do you do in a country that has many traditions going on at one time? Aren't they then the plural, the holidays?
Well, I think that there needs to be true multiculturalism and true tolerance. And part of true tolerance is an acceptance of the fact that people celebrating Christmas are doing so because that's the holiday that they celebrate, not to demean or exclude others. And Christmas really is unique. It has been the central holiday of Western culture for centuries.
Tom Pytek, hold it there. We've got to take a short break. Kathy Young will be right back. We're talking tonight about public displays of religious celebration. We're at 1-800-423. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about public displays of religious celebration at the holidays and whether America's gone too far in pulling the plug on the holidays, on Christmas. You can join the conversation tonight. Have court decisions, zoning rules, and modern manners gone too far in running Mary, Joseph, Jesus, even Santa out of town? Or in multicultural, multi-religion America, are we showing just the right amount of restraint? How do we celebrate great religious traditions while respecting the country's great diversity? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight from Middleton, New Jersey, Kathy Young joins us. She's a contributing editor at Reason Magazine. And from Strongsville, Ohio, Tom Pytek. He's an attorney and frequent contributor to Chronicles Magazine and the American Conservative. And Tom Pytek, I'm sorry, I had to cut you off there for the break, but you were saying that given the historical stature of Christmas, it's now underrepresented in the U.S. culture?
Oh, I think that's certainly the case. I mean, when you look at Christmas, you're looking at the principal holiday for Western civilization for centuries. And you can think of artists you associate with Christmas, and you can think of Giotto, basically the father of Western painting, Bach, one of the leading figures in Western music, Dickens, one of the most powerful novelists in the English language. And you simply cannot associate the other winter holidays with figures of comparable stature, and partly because those holidays are not particularly important in their own traditions.
What do you mean by that?
Well, Hanukkah traditionally was a minor holiday. It was not, did not have the significance of Passover, Rosh Hashanah, or Yom Kippur. It is not a Jewish Christmas, and that's what I meant when I referred earlier to a false multiculturalism. If we are to study, obviously, other cultures, including obviously non-Western cultures that have come into America, I think we should do them the favor of studying what's been important to them, and not just because Christmas has been an important time traditionally in America to exaggerate the importance of traditions that have not been terribly important historically and do not have great cultural significance.
So what's the evidence that you would cite, Tom Pytek, that Christmas is somehow falling into second-class status or not properly observed, relatively speaking?
Well, I can cite an example from my own family. My sister's son attended public school in a upper-middle-class Detroit suburb where the student body was overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly, at least nominally, Christian. And the teachers in that school were forbidden to even mention the word Christmas, and they taught quite a bit about Hanukkah and Kwanzaa, so much to the point that my nephew came back a couple years ago wondering why we did not celebrate Hanukkah or Kwanzaa, because the only holidays he heard about outside the home were Hanukkah and Kwanzaa. There was just no mention of Christmas at all in the curriculum.
So some people might say after centuries of kind of self-absorption, this in a diverse contemporary America is a healthy opening of the windows.
Well, I don't think that's a widespread sentiment, and I would draw your attention to a recent piece in the Edmonton Journal in Canada written by a non-Christian, where she talks about the disappearance of Christmas music. She writes, "Traditional carols are beautiful songs. They combine rich lyric poetry with melodies of timeless power. The intricate harmonies and modalities of real carols don't just move our hearts, they train our ears to appreciate more sophisticated musical forms and our voices to sing in concert with others. You don't have to believe in the Christmas story to appreciate their beauty, depth, and cultural significance." And if you have a school program where there are no Christmas carols being sung, no Christmas carols being learned, that tradition of beauty is not being passed along. And it's not being passed along because some people find it offensive, and I think that's going too far.
Kathy Young, you have seen or read about the film Bad Santa, which has got this really kind of vulgar Santa figure.
And you said I have not actually seen the film.
Right. But you've got the gist of it and said, hey, let's not get all bent out of shape about this. Tom Pytek saw or read about the film and is fairly bent out of shape about it. But your message in here, Kathy Young, is to people on all sides is to lighten up. Now, can you accommodate
Tom Pytek's concern that he feels Christmas kind of vanishing before his eyes with lightning up.
That when you're talking about the kind of situation that Tom just mentioned, where you have a lot of talk about Hanukkah and Kwanzaa in a public school and any mention of Christmas is forbidden, yeah, I think that that's a really, really outrageous situation. And I do think that this is really a kind of mockery of what true diversity or true multiculturalism would be. I think, you know, probably the position here that is taken by the people who would advocate that is that, well, in a majority Christian culture, you already have the kids hearing a lot about Christmas at home, so, you know, there's no reason to reinforce that at school and, you know, make the minority kids feel excluded. But I don't really agree with that. I think if you are going to talk about the different holidays, then you should certainly include Christmas in that. And I don't see what harm it does to people who don't celebrate Christmas. They're not really being forced to celebrate it. They're just basically being encouraged to learn something about it. I don't think there's any problem here. And
Of course, once we open the door, and the door is open and it's been closed back and forth in recent decades. But there are many other people who would like to make public display of their, you know, religion as well. There are towns where a nativity or creche can't be shown, and some people are upset, though that almost seems like an antique issue now.
Right.
There are other towns where a menorah has been prohibited from being put on display, and people are upset about that.
Right. No, I do think that the question of, you know, once you say that you have to display symbols of different cultures and different holidays, where do you draw the line, and can anyone come and, you know, put up basically whatever they want? I think that there are certain reasonable limits. I mean, I don't think that just because you're saying that different groups can sort of put up their holiday symbols, it should also be okay for anyone to, let's say, put up political slogans in the same space. I don't think that necessarily follows.
Still lines to be drawn, but not easy to draw those lines anymore. Kathy Young, Tom Pytek, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Provo, Utah, Frederick Mark Geddix. He's law professor at Brigham Young University. He's author of Choosing the Dream, The Future of Religion in American Public Life. Good evening and welcome, Frederick Mark Geddix.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Help us with the legal context of this whole debate. Tom Pytek says, you know, watch out. There's a kind of war going on against Christmas. Kathy Young says, let's lighten up a little bit and not be so overly concerned about expressions of religion around the holidays. How does this fit into the legal framework, to the precedents that the courts have established?
I think an important distinction that's often missing from these debates is whether it's private individuals who are being prohibited from expressing themselves or whether it's the government itself that is being prevented from endorsing or participating in a certain kind of religious celebration. I'm not familiar with all the incidents and situations that Mr. Pytek and Ms. Young have mentioned, but I'm quite skeptical, frankly, of claims that individuals are being prevented from displaying Christmas trees on private property. That has to be, I would think, a case about the government using government funds to purchase a Christmas tree or a nativity scene or something.
Well,
like
we saw,
that.
I guess, the case that was in the news recently. There was a case in Chicago, in a Chicago suburb, Glenview, where it was government property. It was a firehouse. And the firemen had put up a Christmas tree and lights inside the firehouse and were asked by the town to take that down. Now, does that fall into a proper enforcement of, you know, law as it stands today in this country?
I myself think that's a bureaucratic overreaction. I think Ms. Young stated the law very well, that symbols like Santa Claus or Christmas trees, reindeer and elves, those are whatever their religious orients back in the mists of time, those are clearly secular symbols, and the mere fact that they refer to a Christian holiday is simply not enough to violate the Establishment Clause.
So is anything then prohibited under the law other than very clearly, overtly religious symbols on public property? I mean, this concern about Christmas carols in school, or for that matter, other religious song in school, is that prohibited under law?
Well, as we move from public property to schools, I think the situation becomes much more complicated. In answer to your first question, I think no. I think as long as the government, in terms of public displays, is acknowledging the holiday in a neutral way without endorsing the theological sentiments that it represents, that's okay. So government can certainly display a nativity scene as long as it displays everything else that's associated with the holiday. That has the effect, frankly, of draining the theological content of the nativity scene, but that's what the law is. When you move into schools, though, I think that distinction is much harder to maintain. You have children in elementary schools in particular who are quite vulnerable to the suggestions of their teachers. And the line between teaching about a holiday and participating in the holiday, I think, is very blurred. I don't know what singing a Christmas carol, how that works out in terms of that kind of distinction. One can certainly imagine a Muslim or a Jew singing a very theological Christmas carol, O Come All Ye Faithful, for example.
And thinking, wait a minute.
And understanding their parents would be, plausibly and understandably upset by that.
Tom Pytek, let me pull you in here. You write about what you call you say there is now raging a war against Christmas. Do you see that in the law and current interpretation of the law, or is this where, you know, cultural norms have gone out beyond the law?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. I think there are people who don't like the public display of Christmas, and they've certainly used the law to dampen that. But I certainly think it goes beyond the law. It's a reflection of cultural norms, a belief that an expression of one's own tradition is necessarily an affront to those who do not share it. And I think that belief is not well-founded, but I think that's certainly part of what's going on here.
And so, Kathy Young, please.
Yeah, I do think that we have to make a distinction, though, between, on the one hand, the government forcing people to, refrain from public expressions of, let's say, Christmas celebrations, and people privately making a choice to express themselves in a way that they think is not going to offend others. And again, one may say that they're being hypersensitive. I mean, I remember that years ago I was working for a private company when I was just starting out in the workplace as a secretary, and they were sending out Christmas greetings to the customers, holiday greetings. Yeah. And they decided not to use Christmas stamps with the Virgin Mary on them, because they felt that this might be offensive to Jewish and other non-Christian customers. So instead of that, they used a kind of generic winter symbol, the holiday stamp. You may say that it's being hypersensitive, and I'm sure there are a lot of Jewish people who would not be offended by getting an envelope with a Christmas stamp on it. But at the same time, if they feel that this is good for their customer relations, it's really their private decision.
That's clearly their choice to make. I want to go to Glenville, Illinois, for just a second. We've got Joe Wade there. He's assistant village manager in Glenview. Good evening, and welcome, Joe Wade.
Good evening. Happy Festivus, everyone.
Right. Happy holidays, Joe. Joe, tell us the story of what happened with the Christmas decorations in a firehouse in Glenview.
Okay. Oh boy. Yeah, we've kind of become a full employment act for talk radio here, But here's what happened. A few weeks ago, or maybe backtrack, we've had a policy for some years about not decorating our public buildings, our public works building, a police station, village hall, as well as the fire station.
Right.
And this year, the firefighters at one of the stations put up outside a Santa Claus, a Christmas tree, and the lights. And we followed up, and the chief asked them to bring them inside. So they put them inside the station, and they opened up the blinds, so they were still very visible from the street.
Inside, but visible publicly.
Yes, sir. And we received complaints about that. In fact, there was one citizen that even threatened a lawsuit. So the village attorney reviewed the issue and reviewed our policy, and he issued a legal opinion to the village president and board of trustees to remove the decorations.
Now, this wasn't a nativity scene or a cross. This was a Christmas tree and Christmas lights, as I understand.
Correct.
And a Santa Claus.
Correct.
Okay.
And not to speak for the village attorney, but a key part of his his opinion wasn't so much the religious issue, but he viewed it as an issue of freedom of expression. And his concern was is that if we use public buildings to display symbols that are associated with a holiday or with a religion or any other type of sentiment or philosophy,
right,
then we would be opening ourselves up to if somebody wanted to display another symbol that perhaps is distasteful, something a swastika or something along those lines.
And you had a citizen who was uncomfortable. Frederick Mark Geddix, what about this circumstance? Christmas tree lights, Christmas tree, a Santa inside but visible through the window of a public firehouse. Did this have to go?
Well, I think what the city manager says makes a lot of sense. If you have a policy that your buildings are not going to be decorated for any reason, then to make an exception for Christmas, mm-hmm, I think, does open up a variety of problematic possibilities from the standpoint of the city, where you might lose control over your public buildings or lose control over the individual expressions of city employees.
And pretty soon you can't say what's going up there.
Pardon me?
Pretty soon you can't say what's going up there.
Well, that's the danger. There is, I would say, a considerable stretch. That is, there's a lot of distance between allowing a Christmas tree in the face of that policy and then having all the city buildings constituting public forums at which anybody can say anything.
Joe Wade, let me ask you, Joe, I know I have to lose you at the break, Joe Wade. How's this gone down in Glenview? Does the town seem fairly happy with it, or given all the attention that's been focused on it, do you think you're going to turn around next year and make more allowance for Christmas decorations or for menorahs and Kwanzaa decorations as well? Which way are you headed? Are you going to stand pat or move now?
No, the village board, or at least the village president, expressed last week, there's quite a bit of local television coverage, and he did express that he wants to review the policy. So I think they're going to look at it from a different angle in response to the question about what the expression of public opinion. We've probably received maybe 900 to 1,000 emails, phone calls, faxes. And I haven't seen one that has supported us. So that's kind of been the balance of public opinion.
And you know, yet there was at least one person who was uncomfortable because of those decorations.
Correct. And one of the points, there's many layers to this issue. And one issue is, I heard a little bit of the discussion before I came in. One
yeah.
of the points that we also considered is we're in the police and fire and public works and building inspection services business.
Mm-hmm.
It's really not our business to really advertise or promote different holidays. And although, I mean, people also point out, well, like every other town, we also have the decorations on the streetlights and such. But
the decorations say season's greetings. They don't say Merry Christmas.
Right. And they're typically the green... Holly type decoration.
Right. Nice and open to everybody. Joe Wade, I know we have to lose you here at the break, but thank you very much for joining
okay.
us tonight.
Thank you.
Joe Wade is assistant village manager in Glenview Village, Illinois, where the Christmas decorations are down at Firehouse 7. We're talking tonight about public displays of religious celebration at the holidays. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about public expressions, public displays of religious celebration at the holidays, and whether America has gone too far in pulling the plug. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you feel overrun by symbols of the reason for the season, or are you hungry for more? Is political correctness reducing Christmas to nothing but a shopping holiday? And does a secular, multicultural society need limits on public religious expression? Does the U.S. have the right balance? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking tonight from Provo, Utah, with Frederick Mark Geddix. He's a law professor at Brigham Young University. From Middleton, New Jersey, with Kathy Young, a contributing editor at Reason Magazine and columnist for the Boston Globe. And from Strongsville, Ohio, with Tom Pytek, an attorney and frequent contributor to The American Conservative. We're joined right now by Hans calling from Oregon, Wisconsin. Hi, Hans. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to make two points, one anecdotal and one a little more seriously.
Okay.
The first one is that although I live in the shadow of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, I decided to come out and start saying Merry Christmas to people again.
You decided to come out. Okay.
Yeah.
Meaning, what do you mean by that, Hans?
Just for a while, I was always like, well, can I say Merry Christmas to people? And I decided this year I'm just going to say it unless I happen to know that they don't celebrate Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a neat thing because people have liked it. I almost sense a relief among some people.
But what if the person that you give this greeting to doesn't celebrate Christmas?
Then I'd say I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to offend you.
Okay. But it's the greeting you're using, and you've got another thought on that.
Yeah. It interests me how we have these ideas about here's what's religion and here's what's secular. And we say we're a secular society. I hear a lot of people assert that we're a secular society.
Mm-hmm.
And my perspective on religion is an outlook towards life, which is based on articles of faith, not on facts. And when I look at our nation, our government, and our society in that light, I would say that our national religion is economic growth.
So you're saying never mind about all the religious traditions, it's the shopping and the consumer face that's front and center.
Yeah, I mean, we call it secular. I invite other people to just look at it like, hey, this is a religion.
So you'd call it economic and put the religion right there. Hans, thanks for your call.
I question whether it's legitimate to call our government secular.
In the first place. We've got it, Hans, and thanks for sharing that with us. Kathy Young, Tom Pytek, I want to cut right to the heart of this if we can. Mm-hmm. Kathy, you write kind of in a tongue-in-cheek way about all this, and you say at the end, lighten up.
I think it's a serious issue.
You say that it could even generate a backlash. Tom Pytek, you write in a pretty serious, even angry way about this, about an aggressive war of multiculturalism on Christmas. Let me ask each of you, is this just the old nativity on the courthouse lawn debate, or is there something more serious brewing here in the relations of people of different religions, of different views on religion in the United States? Tom, is something serious going on here, or is this just the kind of regular ebb and flow of American conversation?
No, I think it's something serious, and I think one of the things that's serious about it is when the overriding concern, as laudable as that may be, is not to offend others rather than celebrating one's own tradition. Instead of adding to the beauty that has traditionally been associated with Christmas, such additions stop. I mean, think about a TV program that probably has fond memories, evokes fond memories of anyone my age, which is A Charlie Brown Christmas,
mm-hmm.
A wonderful show, widely praised in 1965. I doubt that program would ever appear on network television today. You have no mention of a holiday other than Christmas. You have a religious Christmas play in a public school. You have Linus reciting from the Gospel of Luke, and you end with the Peanuts singing "Hark the Herald Angels Sing."
And now
no way that would be produced today.
You write, Tom Pytek. You say Christmas is within sight. Is Christmas being reduced to an undistinguished, uninspiring public celebration devoid of religious or cultural significance, or indeed of beauty, with nothing left but multiculturalist pap and tawdry commercialism? Kathy Young, is Tom Pytek overwrought, or where are we here?
Point that I would like to make, and I think that's something important to remember, is that we definitely still have celebrations of Christmas in the private sphere, including churches,
mm-hmm.
And I think that's something important to remember. I think one location for religious celebrations is church, and I don't think anyone is infringing on that. And so to some extent, I think it is a little bit exaggerated. And I think maybe we're paying a little too much attention to public property here. So I think, you know, what goes on within families, what goes on within churches, what goes on within communities in general is very important. And I don't think anyone is taking that away. So to some extent, I mean, I think that there are valid concerns, but I think that there is a bit of exaggeration as well.
Let's get one more call. Sam's calling from Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Yes. I'd like to make that distinction, too. That is between public property and private property and church property.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no law banning churches or private individuals erecting a creche or cross or, or a Muslim symbol or a Buddhist symbol. Or
have at it. Celebrate to your heart's content.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But when you're asking to put a display of religious significance on public property, I think that's a no-no. And I think that once you open that door, of course, in the past, no one objected when the majority Christians did whatever they pleased.
Right.
But I think now we have substantial minority Muslims. Now we have plenty of Buddhist temples around.
Sure.
And who knows, we have Druids, we have Wiccans, and we have all kinds of people who believe in some kind of supernatural. I'm not a particular believer myself.
But they're all citizens, and they're all sharing this country. Tom Pytek, can we have this very diverse American culture and at the same time, from where you stand, have a sufficient observance of the religious qualities of the holiday that you observe?
Well, yeah, I think we can, and I think one way we can do that is by trusting local communities instead of running to the courts and asking them to adjudicate everything. The manager from Glenview, it's very interesting. One person complained, 1,000 people said, keep the decorations, and the decorations went. I think that's absurd. If you have a community where the number of people who celebrate Christmas is 30% and the number of people who observe Hanukkah is 30% and the number of people who observe Ramadan is 10%, well, I think a different accommodation is called for. But when you have a handful of individuals, literally a handful of individuals, and because of their complaints, traditions that are appreciated by the overwhelming majority in the community disappear, I think that's going too far.
Frederick Mark Geddix, we've just got a minute left, but let me put it to you. Does the current state of interpretation of the law account for the kind of ratio awareness that Tom describes there?
No, it really doesn't, and I'm not sure that it should. It's unclear to me why anyone should be able to enlist government resources in support of their religious holidays. So whether it's Christmas, whether they think it's the most important holiday in Western civilization, or whether it's some other holiday, I think that's the crux of the matter. I think the public schools are very difficult because that's an area where public and private sort of meet. But when you're talking about the courthouse, the town square, local government budgets, people ought to support Christmas with their own funds, not with the government.
The law's pretty clear there. But what an interesting issue, the way this is kind of going beyond the realm of law into broader questions now of where Christmas shows up and where it doesn't in the culture more generally. Frederick Mark Geddix, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
It's my pleasure.
Frederick Mark Geddix, law professor at Brigham Young University, and Tom Pytek, thank you for being with us.
It was my pleasure.
Tom Pytek writes for the American Conservative, and Kathy Young in Middletown, New Jersey, thanks very much for being on.
Thank you.
Kathy Young, contributing editor at Reason Magazine and a regular columnist for the Boston Globe. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, what to do with those unwanted holiday gifts. This is On Point. It is the week after Christmas, which can only mean one thing. It's time to figure out what to do with that chia pet, the reindeer sweater, and the other holiday presents that don't really fill a need in your life. For many, it means returning to the mall for store credit. But Massachusetts resident Joan Wickersham has a better idea. In this radio diary, she shares her recipe for handling reject gifts.
I have an old friend who always comes to visit me at New Year's. We talk about the past. We talk about our husbands and our kids and our work. And invariably, because it's the end of December, we talk about dud presents. Dud presents are as much a part of the holiday season as lights and music and turkeys. Let's be frank, they are turkeys. They're the ones where you open them and cry, "Oh, you shouldn't have," and you really mean it. One year my mother gave me something called a couch potato, a shapeless, blobby red fleece garment with no arms or legs, just little holes for your hands and feet to poke through. She must have thought it would be cozy. I thought it was shapeless, blobby, and depressing. It made me feel like a giant ketchup spill. My friend's parents once gave her an automatic bread-making machine. They knew she got up early to make her own bread, and they thought this was a great present. Now she could wake up to fresh bread for breakfast without doing all the work. They didn't realize that the work was precisely the thing she liked. being alone in the quiet kitchen, kneading the warm dough, making something patiently with her hands. Her parents had chosen it so carefully, so personally for her. But my friend hated it, and hating it made her feel like a heel. The question with dud gifts is always what to do with them. Do you return them or donate them to charity or sell them on eBay? For years, my personal solution has been to hang on to them and Potemkinize. Potemkin was the Russian prince who used to build fake villages along Catherine the Great's tour routes to make her think that her empire was richer than it actually was. Like him, I am willing to falsify reality to keep my friends and family happy. Potemkinizing consists of keeping unwanted gifts in the basement and bringing them upstairs whenever the givers come to visit. Potemkinizing means using the ugly chip and dip plate, wearing the ugly sweater, displaying the ugly coffee table book. It's a chicken-hearted thing to do. You're taking something simple and innocent, the social white lie that says, "I love your present," and blowing it up into a giant falsehood that screams, "I don't know how I managed to exist before you gave it to me." One Christmas, about 15 years ago, we were given a microwave oven by my father-in-law's second wife, who was in the process of divorcing him. This microwave was a generous present, but it was a dud, something I didn't want. I thanked her warmly and put it down in the basement. A year or so later, she came to visit. Feeling very clever, I decided to Potemkinize. I hauled the microwave up from the basement and put it on the kitchen counter. When she arrived, I pointed to it and raved about how wonderful it was, even though I'd never touched it and didn't have the slightest idea how it worked. Then she handed me her cup of coffee and said, "Could you warm this up for me?" I don't actually remember what happened at that point. All I know is that 15 years later, we are still good friends, much closer, actually, than we were when she was married to my husband's father. And that, I think, is the point. When she gave us that microwave, she was saying, "Even though I am getting divorced and will therefore no longer technically be a member of your family, I don't want to disappear. I want to stay in your lives." And I, with my clumsy Potemkinizing, wasn't just being cowardly or people-pleasing. I was saying that I didn't want her to disappear either. After all these years, I've started to understand that when I Potemkinize, it's because my feelings about the giver transcend any feelings I might have about the gift. The very best presents are the ones that seem to say, "I love you, I understand you, I know exactly how to make you happy." But let's face it, most presents don't say that. I once bought my husband a beautiful address book in Florence with a leather spine and a marbleized paper cover. He's never mentioned not liking it, but I know it has spent the past 8 years at the bottom of his sock drawer without a single address or phone number filled in. As for the microwave, I kept it and figured out how to use it and eventually came to depend on it to the point that when it broke recently, I replaced it with another one. And as for the couch potato, maybe the best thing is just to indulge in a little radio Potemkinizing and say, "Mom, I'm wearing it right now."
Joan Wickersham is a writer. She lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.